When a few highly educated women executives collectively decided to opt out of the culture of corporate HQ about 20 years ago and announced that they were choosing to leave the workforce to raise their children, the New York Times heralded this as a great moment in the story of the empowerment of women. At the time, journalist Lisa Belkin called it the opt-out revolution. It was their dreams that became the revolution. But 20 years later, the reality of what they experienced, including a recession, is a sobering tale of discovering that outside the comforting cocoon of privilege, there is still a lot of uncertainty. In an upcoming magazine article for our partner, The New York Times, Lisa Belkin and writer Judith Warner decided to return to those women who had previously been chronicled for their triumphant escape from the corporate world to see where they are now and whether they would consider their decision the right one. New York Times contributing writer Judith Warner is the author of The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In, and Lisa Belkin is currently the senior columnist on life, work, and family for The Huffington Post. And as Lisa explains, profiling this particular group of upper-class women may reveal some lessons for the rest of us.
It was an interesting cohort to look at in the first place because they're not the first group of women to choose between their life and work to have to make these sort of compromises, but they are the first group of women who never thought they'd have to make those choices. And in a way, the story was as much their surprise that they had to choose as the choice that they made. They were raised to believe they could do it all, and they were the first generation qualified enough to do it all. So to watch the ramifications of those decisions, it's telling. It's important.
So part of the story here, Judith, is the tension of having to decide to opt out and the consequences of that, and then a subsequent tension of deciding, you know, I need to get back into this game as well. Judith?
That's right. But I also think that what Lisa said is really the essence of the story and really gets to the uniqueness of this generation as well, in that these were women, and particularly this cohort of women, who were able earlier in their lives to succeed at a very high level at everything they put their minds to. And they discovered their limits in this period of transition out and then back in.
One of the characters, Sheila O'Donnell, in this story was also profiled on 60 Minutes and, you know, was a part of your original reporting, Lisa. I'm wondering how those original assumptions maybe came back to haunt her as she was forced to revisit some of the things that she said and some of the expectations that she had looking back on her own life.
Yes, she left work because she thought it would save her marriage. She and her husband were just butting heads constantly over these unbelievably long weeks that they were both putting in. And so she came home, and as Judy tells the story, she discovered that, you know, they were constantly fighting about other things now, and she felt powerless in this marriage. A lot of her power had come from her earnings. And so she's now divorced. She's back in the workplace. You know, the moral of the story in part is she's back in the workplace in a job that does not pay nearly as much as her old one, but also doesn't require nearly as much of her as her old one. And she, you know, she feels like she made the right choice, but there was a price to be paid. And I really think the lesson is that if you took any group of women of that age over that period of time, they're going to have all the problems that this group of women had, whether or not they kept working or opted out. You know, life got in the way.
Judith, one of the interesting scenes in this story is how one of the women was advised that even though having a job might change the economic calculation in a divorce settlement, that in fact it was so much more psychologically important for her to actually have a job, regardless of what the economic consequences are, and that that was a huge insight for her going forward.
Yes, that she needed to think of this, her lawyer said to her, not as a decision that would just affect her in the months or even the years to come, but as one that would affect her in the decades to come. And that as she moved forward in her settlement also, the less power her husband had over her, the better equipped she would be to sort of stand her ground and get what she needed. And I think that in that case, in that particular marriage, what you saw was that power dynamics that were in place beforehand sort of got worse in the particular situation of Sheila's having taken herself out of the workforce, having lost that sense of identity and that ability to earn her own income, which was particularly important for her.
Lisa, as someone who hears from women at all sort of economic levels, middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class, Do you think there's a wisdom in the ways in which lower and working class couples and families and women particularly make these kinds of choices that would help some of these very, very successful women from the executive cohort that Judith looked at?
Oh, let's not romanticize anyone's choices here. They're all hard, and they're all limited. Every social economic strata wishes they didn't have those limits. I think that these are particular choices of a very elite group. But I think that's not insignificant. These are the women who should be running the world, who, when we look around and say, why aren't there women in more positions of power? Here's our answer, because these women decided not to be there. And the fact that they're not in positions of power means that they're not there to change the workplace for other women of all levels coming up behind them. So this is only applicable to a small group, but it's still important to all of us.
Judith Warner, the recession that began in 2008 had a huge impact on the male executive class, who were compelled to opt out for various reasons economically, but it probably had consequences for the families, certainly. In terms of the women's lessons for opting out and opting in, what do you think men are going to learn over the next 10 years that's relevant to what you've already reported on?
I think men have always known that they don't really have these choices. I mean, the concept of there being a choice has been something that women have claimed that has been socially permissible for them, and that really hasn't been for men.
Judith Warner is a New York Times contributing writer, author of the Times article, The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In. She's author of the book Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. And the reporting in The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In came in part from work that was originally done by Lisa Belkin, Huffington Post senior columnist on life, work, and family. Lisa and Judith, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
This is Erica from Livingston, New Jersey. When I announced I was pregnant, my mentor said to me, "Welcome to the mommy track." I spent the past 15 years learning what that meant. Being a mom to my kids is the best thing I have or will ever do, but I'm constantly fighting that sinking feeling that I've failed because I didn't live up to my generation's unfounded expectation that we really could have it all.
We want to hear about your experience. How does having children alter your work life? Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE and follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.